came from one of those conflicts the MLA is in the habit of scheduling to prevent, you know, we all know about that. Well, I'll start with a poem called Carrington. And there's a headnote which explains who Carrington is, which I've taken from that very wonderful book that Karen Peterson and J.J. Wilson did, Women Artists, and I'll just quote. Carrington, a promising young art student at The Slade, threw off her middle-class origins and her first name, Dora, got a room of her own and found there three demons, loneliness, laziness, and lust. What the poem was about was finding a better name for those demons, really. Or was it fear made the brush so heavy she put it down, wondering what could matter enough to bother finding a form to fill with it? When she cleared the breakfast things, scrubbed stains from the table, when she checked the mail, pondered who might come to call, when she brushed her hair and felt her face for lines, what was left for the canvas, the vision, the hand to describe when it was too tired to feel its fingers, too fearful of finding its limits too soon, too narrow, too certain its gifts were, as they had predicted, merely minor. She stayed clear of the paint box, slouched low in the wicker chair, sipped tea in loneliness or with friends avoiding loneliness, or with a lover who offered a way out of her own room where the air was stifling. Was it lust pushed her up the stairs into dim parlors, dinners sucking on ice? She painted little, a subtle portrait of Strachey, who published 8 books and accepted her reverence, time, and tea. This poem is called Sign, and it's on a poster that I did jointly with an artist, Paula King, that Joan has there, that we're selling to benefit the Rachel Lee Potline in Portland, which is where I work, Portland, Oregon. The first part of it is a newspaper article that was in the Oregonian in January of this year. Two deaf-mute women used sign language to escape a pair of kidnappers and would-be rapists Saturday morning near Kenton Park, according to police reports. While one woman led the two kidnappers into the woods, the other locked the car's doors. The woman who had gone with the two men ran back to the automobile, and both victims escaped unharmed. Real interesting trick of language, that these women were not victimized. They escaped, yet the newspaper calls them victims. They're so used to it. My fingers move sly against your palm. Like women everywhere, we speak in code. Hear me. If you run, if they follow, if twigs crack under their shoes, our bones will hear them stumble, unnerved by our sudden wisdom. Fear is not useful. Doing nothing is also dangerous. Show me your hands. Now. I run, you lock the car. I run, you start the car. I run, you wait, the car ready. You wait, the car ready. I run, I see you, the car. The door opens, my breath, your hands. Now I'm going to read another poem about this not very favorite subject. It's called August 1977. I was in Brooklyn, New York, during August when the Son of Sam craze was at its peak. I mean, I was quite as caught up in it as anybody else, you know, the way the newspapers were and everybody being terrified and thinking of, you know, how to protect yourself. And at the same time knowing that Son of Sam was a teeny-weeny fraction of the kind of violence that was being visited against women all the time. The sky breaks into thunder, knocks out the streetlight. I'm reading the paper. Son of Sam, who shoots women with hair like my sister's, long, dark, except last night the woman was blonde for the first time. It was in Brooklyn for the first time. This house is too hot for protection. All day on the subway, at work, over coffee, people read papers. The Times suspects that he hates women. Headlines widen the circle behind our eyes. We wonder how to be safe. What hair, what place, what company? Somewhere a man reads the paper, counts the women with long dark hair, and now blonde hair too. He makes his plans. I dream. I go to pinch my nephew's cheek. Whiskers sprout under my thumb. He's gone. That's why when I wake to see him making his dolls fight, Thor against Hulk, I'm confused. Then over breakfast, he imagines me fighting a rapist. He plays both parts, and he do this, and you do that, and he, and you, and I'll kill anyone who... No, he said, I won't wear them. Those are girls' jeans. At night, my sister and I stretch over the bed by the window, watching. Each man who walks through the dark heat in a thin shirt, twirling his keychain, might be a rapist, wife beater, killer. We make what are called sick jokes. Maybe Son of Sam is Andy's brother, killing the woman who finally left, or Sarah's husband, or our uncle screaming as he screamed at his sister, you little slut, you whore. If the Sons of Sam are named at our table, whose daughters are we? When we sleep, if we sleep through the long hot night, we should dream how Lilith refused to lie under him, how Judith lopped off his head, how Clytemnestra stabbed him for killing their daughter, how Procne fed him children in a pie for raping her sister, how Penthesilea made war. Instead, in the dark, men people our dreams, move closer, stretch hands out, smile, sure they can reach. Micole on my lap at the party cries, why do boys hate girls? We could prowl the streets in packs like female lions. We could name ourselves Blood to Inez, Joanne, Yvonne, and all the women who got away, and all the women who lived through it, and all the women who died because of it, nameless. How many millions called witches and burned, how many millions called, at best, victims and raped. In this country, one every minute, two or three while I read this poem. Imagine there is no rape. Let half your dreams slip from you. Let the dry throat open. You're out after midnight. Air feels cold in your nostrils, smells clear. The man at the edge of the park is no more dangerous than ducks or geese silent along the pond, or the tree at the path turning where you leave the path to sit in the dark on the wet grass. You wonder how long before morning. You wonder why grass smells sweet. I never know what to do after I bring that photo. Breathe. I guess I'll read one more. Called Survival is an Act of Resistance. And if anybody knows who first said that, I know somebody said it first. I would love to know. No? No? I'll keep asking. First, suffer. Second, repeat after me. It's my fault. Understand that you yourself have caused your pain, or that you are wicked and selfish to complain, or that this suffering is good for something, heaven, or character, or just practice for what comes next. Third, treat the subject delicately, even among friends. Sweat when you think, if anyone knew, how stupid you really are, how you hate your job, how you smack your kids, what your face looks like under makeup, that your breasts have hairs which you pluck, how your husband's body disgusts you, how his friend's body turns you on, how your own body turns you on, how her breasts sway, and how you're sweating. So be ashamed to bring it up over coffee, or over fake coffee, because real coffee takes too long. If you do, over whatever passes for coffee, mention whatever passes for your fault, finding it's her fault too. Watch her like a mirror you want to break. You go home lighter, able to make dinner. That night you take him inside to pound your cervix. Mea culpa, you cry in your orgasm if you have one. The survivor is busy surviving. The waking is never slow enough. Go under, they have said it all your life. In and out of groups, you notice nine women on the rug in a circle feel just as guilty as you for hating his sock smell, for how he says the same way every third night, coming to bed soon? It's not a question, they notice too. The door opens, walk through with a suitcase, toss awake over money, the dark, and the car, hole up for weeks in a bathrobe, hands tight in your pockets, fall through the black pit of your brain, touching for bottom. Your feet find there's a floor to stand on. Check out the corners for pencils and dusty change. Fix your own toilet, answer the phone, discover you like your face. Over coffee, your heart spills. Her eyes are full as yours. You're scared. There were stories, remember? Now they come true. You laugh deep from your stomach, and she laughs too. Your insides shock open. Her body comes open. She smells like the sea. Delicious. You laugh open, and she laughs too. Your brain opens. Let it. Your body swims into reach. Climb in. Learn it with caution. The black speckled notebook begins with a question. Who is the subject? Speak what you know. I am an edge to balance. One cell of the planet, also the planet's eye, also the woman who learns how to season and stir on one foot and dance. Sometimes the ground is not firm. Sometimes no one has stood this ground before. Next reader is Adrienne Rich.
Getting rid of my chewing gum, which is not a regular habit of mine.
Don't apologize.
An antidote to coffee. I'm not apologizing.
I'm just
explaining. I'm going to begin with a poem called Natural Resources. And in it, I quote something that was quoted in the newspaper from one of the women who organized the Irish Women's Peace Movement. She said, we had lived with violence for 7 years. It was not worth one single life. Natural resources. The core of the strong hill not understood, the mulch heat of the underwood, where unforeseen the forest fire unfurls, the heat, the privacy of the mines, the rainbow laboring to extend herself, where neither men nor cattle understand, arching her lusters over rut and stubble, purely to reach where she must go, the emerald lying against the silver vein, waiting for light to reach it, breathing in pain. The miner laboring beneath the ray of the headland, a weight like death. The miner is no metaphor. She goes into the cage like the rest, is flung downward by gravity like them, must change her body like the rest, to fit a crevice, to work a load. On her the pick hangs heavy, the bad air lies thick, the mountain presses in on her with boulder, timber, fog. Slowly the mountain's dust descends into the fibers of her lungs. The cage drops into the dark. The routine of life goes on. A woman turns a doorknob, but so slowly, so quietly, that no one wakes, and it is she alone who gazes into the dark of bedrooms, ascertains how they sleep, who needs her touch, what window blows the ice of February into the room, and who must be protected. It is only she who sees, who is trained to see. Could you imagine a world of women only? The interviewer asked. Can you imagine a world where women are absent? He believed he was joking. Yet I have to imagine at one and the same moment both, because I live in both. Can you imagine, the interviewer asked, a world of men? He thought he was joking. If so, then, a world where men are absent. Absently, wearily, I answered, yes. Phantom of the man who would understand, the lost brother, the twin. For him did we leave our mothers, deny our sisters over and over? Did we invent him, conjure him over the charring log, nights late in the snowbound cabin? Did we dream or scry his face in the liquid embers, the man who would dare to know us? It was never the rapist, it was the brother lost, the comrade twin, whose palm would bear a lifeline like our own, decisive, arrowy, forked lightning of insatiate desire. It was never the crude pestle, the blind ramrod we were after. Merely a fellow creature with natural resources equal to our own. Meanwhile, another kind of being was constructing itself blindly. A mutant, some have said, the blood-compelled exemplar of a botched civilization, as one of them called it. Children picking up guns, for that is what it means to be a man. We have lived with violence for 7 years. It was not worth one single life. But the patriot's fist is at her throat. Her voice is in mortal danger. And that kind of being has lain in our beds, declaring itself our desire, requiring women's blood for life, a woman's breast to lay its nightmare on. And that kind of being has other forms, a passivity we mistake in the desperation of our search for gentleness. But gentleness is active. Gentleness swabs the crusted stump, invents more merciful instruments to touch the wound beyond the wound, does not faint with disgust, will not be driven off, keeps bearing witness calmly against the predator, the parasite. I am tired of faint-heartedness, there having to be exceptional, to do what an ordinary woman does in the course of things. I am tired of women stooping to half our height, to bring the essential vein to light. Tired of the waste of what we bear with such cost, such elation into sight. For what becomes of what the miner probes and carves from the mountain's body in her pain? This is what I am, watching the spider rebuild, patiently, they say, but I recognize in her impatience my own, the passion to make and make again where such unmaking reigns, the refusal to be a victim. We have lived with violence so long. Am I to go on saying, for myself, for her. This is my body. Take and destroy it. The enormity of the simplest things. In this cold barn, tables are spread with china saucers, shoehorns of German silver, a gilt-edged book that opens into a picture frame, a biscuit tin of the 30s. Outside, the north lies vast with unshed snow. Everything is at once remote and familiar. Each house contains what it must. Women simmer carcasses of clean-picked turkeys, store away the cleaned cut glass, and soak the linen cloths. Dark rushes early at the panes. These things by women saved are all we have of them, or of those dear to them. These ribboned letters, snapshots faithfully glued for years onto the scrapbook page. These scraps turned into patchwork, doll gowns, clean white rags for stanching blood, the bride's yellow handkerchief, the child's height penciled on the cellar door. In this cold barn we dream a universe of humble things, and without these, no memory, no faithfulness, no purpose for the future, no honor to the past. There are words I cannot choose again, humanism, androgyny. Such words have no shame in them, no diffidence before the raging, stoic grandmothers. Their glint is too shallow, like a dye that does not permeate the fibers of actual life as we live it now. This fraying blanket with its ancient stains, we pull across the sick child's shoulder, or wrap around the senseless legs of the hero trained to kill. This weaving, ragged because incomplete, we turn our hands to, interrupted over and over, handed down unfinished, found in the drawer of an old dresser in the barn. Her vanished pride and care, still urging us, urging on our work to close the gap in the great nebula, to help the earth deliver. The women who first knew themselves miners are dead. The rainbow flies like a flying buttress from the walls of cloud. The silver and green vein awaits the battering of the pick. The dark load weeps for light. My heart is moved by all I cannot say. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. I want to read a love poem, and I wrote it as a poem to an individual woman, but I think that a great many of our love poems to individual women are also love poems to the growing movement in and of women, to the women we know as our friends, in the sense that Mary Daly defined it last night, our sisters in that larger and deeper sense. This is called Nights and Days. The stars will come out over and over. The hyacinths rise like flames from the windswept turf down the middle of Upper Broadway, where the desolate take the sun. The days will run together and stream into years, as the rivers freeze and burn. And I ask myself and you, which of our visions will claim us? Which will we claim? How will we go on living? How will we touch? What will we know? What will we say to each other? Pictures form and dissolve in my head. We are walking in a city you fled, came back to, and come back to still, which I saw once through winter frost years back, before I knew you, before I knew myself. We are walking streets you have by heart from childhood, streets you have graven and erased in dreams, scrolled portals, trees, 19th century statues. We are holding hands so I can see everything as you see it. I follow you into your dreams, your past, the places none of us can explain to anyone. We are standing in the wind on an empty beach. The onslaught of the surf tells me Point Reyes, or maybe some northern Pacific shoreline neither of us has seen. In its fine spectral mist, our hair is gray as the sea. Someone who saw us far off would say we were two old women, norns perhaps, or sisters of the spray. But our breasts are beginning to sing together. Your eyes are on my mouth. I wake early in the morning in a bed we have shared for years, lie watching your innocent, sacred sleep as if for the first time. We have been together so many nights and days, this day is not unusual. I walk to an eastern window, pull up the blinds. The city around us is still on a clear October morning, wrapped in her indestructible light. The stars will come out over and over. The hyacinths rise like flames from the windswept turf down the middle of Upper Broadway, where the desolate take the sun. The days will run together and stream into years as the rivers freeze and burn. And I ask myself and you, which of our visions will claim us? Which will we claim? How will we go on living? How will we touch? What will we know? What will we say to each other? The next reader is Audre Lorde. I'm sure you know her past books, Coal, Between Ourselves, which was published last year by Eidolon Press. Her new book of poems, The Black Unicorn, will be published in fall of 1978 by W.W. Norton.
Yes, it is possible to live the black lesbian poet, but it's very hard. But on the other hand, so is living, period. Right? And this is a poem, it's called Litany to Survival. This reading's for you. For those of us who live at the shoreline, who stand upon the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone, for those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice, who love in doorways, coming and going, in the hours at dawn, looking inward and outward at once, before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures like bread in children's mouths, so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. For those of us who are imprinted with fear like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk or by this weapon,
this illusion of some safety, the heavy-footed hope to silence us, for all of us know instant and triumph, we were not meant to survive. So when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it will not rise. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard or welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. It is better to speak. Remember, we were not meant to survive. The next poem is a poem to my sisters called Harriet. Harriet, there was always somebody calling us crazy, or mean, or stuck up, or evil, or black, and we were nappy girls, quick as cuttlefish, scurrying for cover, trying to speak, pain in each other's mouths, until we learned on the edge of a lash or a tongue, on the edge of the other's betrayal, that respect meant keeping our distance in silence, averting our eyes from each other's face in the street, from the beautiful dark mouth and cautious familiar eyes passing alone. I remember you, Harriet. Before we were broken apart, we dreamed the crossed swords of warrior queens while we avoided each other's eyes. And we learned to know lonely, like the earth learns to know dead. Harriet, what name shall we call ourselves now our mother is gone? Walking our boundaries. I just always love poems, right? So, walking our boundaries. This first bright day has broken the back of winter. We rise from war to walk across our earth around this house, both stunned that sun can shine so brightly after all our pain. Cautiously, we inspect our joint holding. A part of last year's garden still stands, bracken, a tough Miss Okra pod clings to the vine, a parody of fruit, cold, hard, and swollen. Underfoot, one rotten shingle is becoming loam. I take your hand beside the compost heap, glad to be alive and still with you. We talk of ordinary articles with relief, while we peer upward, each half afraid there will be no tight buds started on our ancient apple tree, so badly damaged by last winter's storm. Knowing it does not pay to cherish symbols when the substance quivers close at hand, waiting to be held. Your hand falls off the apple bark like casual fire along my back. My shoulders are dead leaves waiting to be burned alive. The sun is watery warm. Our voices seem too loud for this small yard, too tentative for women so in love. The siding has come loose in spots. Our footsteps hold this place together as our place. Our joint decisions make the possible whole. I do not know when we shall laugh, but next week I know we must spade up another plot for this spring's seeding. funny, you don't get to write the poem, right? The little book called Love Poem. Speak, earth, and bless me with what is richest. Make sky flow honey out of my hips, rigid as mountains spread over a valley caught out by the mouths of rain. And I knew when I entered her, I was high wind in her forest's hollow, fingers whispering sound. Honey flowed from a split cup, impaled on a lance of tongue, on the tips of her breasts, on her navel, and my breath howling into her entrances through lungs of pain. Greedy as herring gulls or a child, I swing out over the earth, over and over again.
I just wanted to say thank you all for coming to this event, and I also would just like to say that I think that, you know, we have been a